back in 1958. Drove an old V8. When we'd gone 100,000, we got out and pushed it a mile. We didn't know who we were, we didn't know what we did. We were just on the road.
Now, if you're listening and you do not know whose voice that is, well, you're in for a great treat, but I'm sure it evokes some great memories for you, as it does with me and my guest Ron Balson, who's here for the next 45 minutes to talk about writing. That is the voice of Bonnie Kolak, and that is the first time anybody in the world listening to a radio has heard her new CD. It's settled, seems like yesterday. It's an amazing Ron Balson. We're not going to spend the whole 45 minutes talking about Bonnie Kolak, but I bet
we
could. I bet we could, couldn't we? You were a big fan, and a lot of people in Chicago sort of revere her. Ron has become a great friend, and also my current favorite novelist, because he keeps turning out these incredibly arresting books. Having come to the business of novel writing relatively late in life, the latest is called The Trust. And, of course, before we get to that, I'm going to do what must happen to you. Whenever you speak, they'll say, Ron, you've had an amazing story. Tell us your story. You wanted to be a writer. You're a lawyer.
Right.
You're practicing it.
Been writing legal briefs for 45 years.
Well, there are a lot of other people who can't do what you do who have been writing legal briefs for 45 years, too. But all of a sudden, to backtrack, and you can look up a story that I wrote about Ron about, I think, a year ago, and the kind of amazing second career he started. He wrote a book. He thought it was quite good. It was titled Once We Were Brothers. It was a novel set in pre- and certainly post-war Germany. And deeply set into Chicago, that his wife Monica liked and his kid liked and you liked, and you tried to get someone else to like it, and nobody liked it. Or was willing, not that they didn't like it, they weren't willing to publish it, right?
I couldn't even find a literary agent. I couldn't even get the door open. You know, you can't get to the publishing houses without going through a literary agent, unless you're a famous person, not a first-time fiction writer.
Sure.
So I couldn't even find a literary agent. I got dozens and dozens of rejections.
Nice rejections or
horrible? Well, they come on postcards.
Really?
Postcards. Wow. And they say the same thing. We're not taking on any new authors, or it doesn't suit our needs at this time, or we don't see the viability of this project, or this one's my favorite. I liked it, but I didn't love it.
Oh, for God's sake.
And I came to believe, Rick, and I know it's true, but I can't prove it, that there's a stationery house somewhere that sells pre-printed rejection postcards.
It says that. It's amazing to me that you didn't get depressed to the point where you said, oh, the hell with it, and stick it in a drawer and forget about it. That you had faith in it, and your wife Monica and your son and others in the small circle who read it. You had enough faith to go about the business, and thank God it's contemporary times, to just self-publish the thing, right?
Yeah, I self-published it. I didn't want to let it go. I had worked on it for 3 years. I liked the story. I wanted to see it in print, whether it ever sold a book or didn't sell a book.
Yeah. And so you ordered, 1,000 copies? I don't remember exactly. 500 copies.
You know, I didn't think too far ahead on this. I went to one of the major printing houses outside Ann Arbor, and I ordered the finest paper and the finest cover and all the rest of that. Why not?
Yeah, sure.
And then I found out you can't place an order for 50 books, you know.
That's what you originally wanted, yeah.
So, I had to order 1,000 books, you know.
And you started selling them. Your son helped you, you know, with the modern technology of selling them and online in
some fashion.
And you would sell one or two a month, or 10 a month, and then 15 a month. And then it kind of exploded, right?
In the fall of 2011, for whatever reason, 1,000 books 1 month, 5,000 the next, and pretty soon 100 and some odd thousand, yeah.
And you thought, what about this? You thought, of course, you're an attorney and you're used to researching things deeply. Did you think this was some kind of like publishing miracle? It must have intrigued you, Ron Balson.
Well, I came to realize that books sell by word of mouth. And really for a lot of people, especially people in book clubs and whatnot, you have to ask yourself, how did I come to read the last book? And it's because someone recommended it. Yeah. Like, here we are. You're recommending my book. I think you can do all the marketing and promotion and have all those strategies. I don't think it means as much as your friends recommending a book.
No, I don't think it does either. And you are the living, breathing, best-selling example of that, as far as I'm concerned. You really are. I have rarely, if ever, heard a publishing story that will follow the philosophy of talent will out. This book called Once We Were Brothers, and we'll talk a little bit about it, made its way into the hands of an executive at a publishing firm who then got in touch with you.
That's right. She was home for the Christmas holidays. She's an editor. She was an executive editor at St. Martin's. And home for the Christmas holidays, and her aunt gave her a copy of the book, my self-published book. And she said, I don't have time for this. I've got 6 manuscripts sitting on my desk due by next Friday.
Yeah.
She said, well, just take it. Just take it and look at it. And so she's sitting on the train going back to New York, and the conductor, who she describes as this gruff old curmudgeon, taps her on the shoulder and he says, hey, that's a good book.
And she dug into it and started reading it. The next thing, she realized how good the book was, called you, made a deal, not just for that book, but for your next book, yes?
Yes. Right.
How did you feel? How empowered? You must have felt at some point, and you too, Monica, his lovely wife sitting in here. You can see her. There's a TV here, so you can see her nodding her head. She doesn't want to come on to talk about the strum and drang of being the wife of a successful novelist. Ron goes, it's boring. It punctuated your faith in your own writing. Yes or no? You're so self-effacing about much of
it. I am self-effacing about it because, you know, it's still hard to get my arms around the fact that so many people are reading my books. Especially when so many people rejected them to begin with.
Sure.
Maybe that's a fallout from
that. Well, the only one hope for me is that all of those so-called agents are smashing their head into the wall saying, I could have. I'm sure they're not, because they would not admit it to their colleagues. I could have had Ron Balson. Once We Were Brothers starts with a real bang here. What I'm trying to do is sell all of Ron's books. We'll talk about The Trust, the latest one, a little later in the show, with a confrontation at the Lyric Opera House with an old, if memory serves, with one old man who works as a starter at the old Waveland, now Merovitz, golf course.
Exactly.
And a billionaire industrialist and philanthropist who the golf starter accuses of having been not his real brother, but very close during the war, and having become a Nazi killer. This grew out of some of your legal traveling especially to Poland.
Right.
Where you, as a Jewish American, didn't know how prominent. I mean, we have the Illinois Holocaust Museum, but living in Chicago, even in many Jewish neighborhoods, you're not daily confronted with the ash of the Holocaust and the war.
Yeah, when you go to Poland, it's unmistakable. You know you're walking on a battlefield. You're walking on a country that ceased to be.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole western half of it was taken and annexed into Germany. The eastern half was to be Lebensraum. It was to be the breathing space for the German people. And Einsatzgruppens, those death squads, were sent in to kill the prominent people and the intellectuals and the wealthy and the whole governmental structure, and the schools were closed, and it ceased to be as a country.
Right.
And if you go there now, and there are monuments, there are memorials everywhere. It's really moving.
It's in the air, and it certainly inspired you. We got to take a little break, but you can listen to the radio. But sometime in the next few hours, do consult ronaldbalson.com. We're gonna talk a little bit about saving Sophie and Carolina's twins, and the latest book, which I finished about 2 weeks ago, called The Trust, which takes place not in Poland or Israel or a little bit Chicago, but in Ireland, in Northern Ireland. Great, great book.
For letting us be here tonight.
Bonnie Kolak, she will be on the radio talking and singing. She'll be talking at 10:30, so stay tuned for that. I'm with Ron Balsam. We're talking about the incredible success of Once We Were Brothers, his first novel that sold, I guess, now hundreds of thousands of copies. That was followed by Saving Sophie, which is set in Israel and Palestine. And then, because you can't, Ron, because it's an emotional thing for you to write about Holocaust-era
events. It's dark. I mean, you sit there for days, and, you know, writing is it's a discipline where you have to sit by yourself and,
sure.
and in a room and write for 5 or 6 hours. And if you're writing about such a dark period, it's it's a difficult thing to do.
Well, the third novel was Carolina's Twins, which was again set in Poland. And it was based on another incredible twist of fate, let's say. It was based on a story that you heard from a woman who contacted you after she had read Once We Were Brothers.
Right. She lived in Lincolnwood.
Yeah.
And called me up and said, I'm a survivor, and I've read a lot of books about the war. But when I read your book, I thought I was reading about my own family. You got it just right. And, you know, no author ever gets better praise than that.
No, no kidding. Yeah. No kidding. You must hear all the time when you go to events, because you do a lot of book events and you speak at a lot of book events and you speak to you know, sadly that crowd of Holocaust survivors is diminishing as we speak. But you must hear at every one of these events from someone, you must sense that you have touched someone in a way that many novelists just can't.
When I speak in areas that had previously a lot of concentration of survivors, because there aren't many left, you'd have to be in your 90s.
Yep.
A lot of times people would come up, either a survivor or a child of a survivor, and they would want to tell me something about their story, which, you know, personally, I was so honored by that. I mean, sometimes they wouldn't even tell their own families, but they would, you know, they would want to share that. And every one of those stories was unbelievable. Every one has determination and bravery and
courage and survival, you know, and heart and
absolutely.
Love and the will to survive. Carolina's Twins is also flies through time. You're very good at, and you do it in the new book too, of seamlessly wandering through time and making it work.
I think that there's a difference between writing historical fiction, a novel, and reading a history book, and hopefully the same information is contained in each, but I believe that if you read historical fiction and you get your arms around some characters and you get engaged in the story, that information will stay with you a lot better than it will in a history book.
No question. When you're putting these characters into areas and positions where you know you have enough foundation through your research, there's no question about it in all of your books, are tremendously well-researched. No question about that either. I mean, you've looked at, you know, train schedules and train plots and
things. Yeah, that's right.
Certainly for Carolina's Twins,
that's
which
right.
is a, an astonishing book. Again,
I had to research the train schedules back from the 1940s to determine exactly where that train would have been at specifically that time and whether there would have been wheat fields available when the event happened. Yeah.
Do you think your experience and your background as a lawyer has helped you? It's certainly a great portion of law is research.
I think so. I've always done my own research. And so I'm a litigation attorney.
Yeah.
And so when I'm writing briefs and I'm arguing on what law applies, and yeah, you have to do a lot of research. And
when doing your own research would ingrain in it in your head and make it kind of part of you in a way that, you know, secondhand research would not.
I never trusted secondhand research.
Good for you.
So I don't have a researcher that helps me with my books. I do them all. You know, sometimes I'm asked, so Ron, what are you reading now? What books are you reading? What authors do you like? And I can remember that question being asked while I was writing The Trust, and I said, they said, what book is on your nightstand?
Right.
And I said, it's a 700-page book on the IRA.
We will talk about The Trust right after the commercial. I'm surprised. Well, pretty soon on your nightstand will be the great Tom Weinberg's book about
Monkey
the Lost City. Monkey God. The Monkey City. The Monkey God. Tom, we're forgetting the name of your book, but it's a great book. That's all we're saying. You are a high school classmate of Ron Paulson's. You're an old, dear friend of mine, and you were actually on the show last week, so there you go. It's all, what high school?
Highland Park.
It's all about Highland Park High School, ladies and gentlemen. We got to take a little break, then we'll get some news, and then Ron and I will spend a few minutes talking about The Trust and how this came to be. It's set in Northern Ireland, and it features of one of my, I've grown very fond of Liam and his wife. Liam is a private eye, and his wife's a lawyer, and they live in Chicago. That's why I like him. We'll be back momentarily, and then we'll get some news, and then Ron and I will carry on.
Said, why don't you stay? I'll even put the snake away. Your face is pale, your coat is torn. Why take it off? I will keep
Ron you. Paulson, as if we were, you would think we were two little high school girls listening to Frank Sinatra in 1947. We're like swooning at Bonnie Kolak. She's one of a kind. You'll hear more from Bonnie, and now we have a few more minutes with Ron to talk about. You can go to Ronald Balson, ronaldbalson.com, to get all sorts of information about his four novels. This one, the seed of this one, where Liam Taggart, a private eye, a married private eye with a small child in Chicago, is compelled back to Ireland, where he spent some interesting years that ended badly. He is back in Ireland trying to deal with a mystery, right? Basically.
Yeah. When I finished writing Carolina's Twins, I told my editor, I want to write a murder mystery now next. And she said, well, that's okay. Go ahead. And I had thought initially I wanted to write the murder mystery about a case that I had had where this young couple, these newlyweds in southern Illinois, were brutally murdered, and no one knew who did it. And there was no reason or no cause or no suspects. And they arrested some shiftless guy, and he spent a lot of years in jail, and finally he got out. And I handled that case. And I thought I'd do that, but then I decided that the case is too close in time and too many people would be identified, and I didn't want to do it. So I was just sitting around trying to think of what to do, And that's a tough time. You finish one book and you don't have something else to work on.
Sure.
I heard John Le Carre on TV not too long ago, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, 60 Minutes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he said that he was very depressed when he had finished a book and didn't know what he was going to write next. And it's kind of a funky time.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
I'll bet.
So then one of my kids said, well, why don't you have one about Liam going back to Ireland and investigating a murder? So I said, well, you know, that sounds pretty good. There's a lot of material back in Ireland.
And, oh, no question.
Yeah.
Did you then go to Ireland to do any?
I'll bet
you did, because, again, one of the hallmarks of all of your books is these are historical novels where the history does not beat you on the head. It is seamlessly part of the larger plot, which I so appreciate. I don't feel like I'm getting any kind of history lesson, but I am. I know I'm getting a history lesson.
Yeah, we all knew about the Troubles. I mean,
sure.
we read about it in the paper, and we listened to Reverend Ian Paisley pounding his fist on the podium, and
mm-hmm.
and we saw Jerry Adams come to Washington to see Clinton, and
of
the
course.
Big hubbub
sure.
that came. But I didn't really know what was going on.
Yeah.
And I knew that there was bombings and people getting killed, and you know, we would hear.
You knew about the Troubles.
Yeah, right. We'd see the movie The Boxer, and
right.
and we'd hear
right.
Nancy Griffith's song, No Place in Ireland, a Child Can Go Alone, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
and I thought that would, you know, I could draw on that. I could, maybe this would be a revenge killing or a vendetta killing coming out of the Troubles, or maybe it's other suspects. And I thought that would make for a good murder mystery.
Well, it sure does. And there is a trust that's been set up and by a person in Ireland who related to Liam. I'm trying not to give it, like, to blow a mystery. I'm not going to.
Well, I think
much.
You can blow that part. That's yeah. just in the first few pages. His
yeah.
uncle dies and sets up a trust and appoints Liam the trustee.
Well, and the point being that the trust cannot be. Are there some bad relatives involved in this mix? This is not, it's not quite a family out of Eugene O'Neill, but there's some good ones too. I mean, you're very creative, Ron, in making this, you know, this strange but compelling family that Liam has to deal with. And he
a lot
has
of disparate personalities.
Yeah, and he has to deal with some ghosts too.
He does.
His
he
own
does.
Demons and ghosts.
Right. He betrayed the family 16 years ago. He's estranged from the family. He didn't want to go back. He gets the call that his uncle has died, and his wife Catherine, she urges him to go back. And not only does he find that his uncle died, but he's been murdered, and that the killer might not be finished.
Yep, and in order for this trust to be disseminated or for the money
distributed,
the killer has to be uncovered.
Yeah, the uncle's specific instructions in the trust were no money was to be distributed to any person until his killer is found and brought to justice.
Yeah.
So the uncle knew he was going to be killed. He knew, but he didn't name his killer.
There's also, in this one, there's also some good, there's been courtroom scenes in some of your previous books. There's a lot of, you know, what I like about this, and I'm sure someone even like Scott Turow or John Grisham would like this, there's some legal stuff going on here, too.
Well, the trust is challenged in the
yeah.
courts, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
They accuse him, his uncle, of being a lunatic, you know.
What did you think? You must be awfully happy with this book.
I am happy with it. Yeah. I like it a lot.
Do you sense, I mean, if we just look at the arc of your novel writing career, Once We Were Brothers, Saving Sophie, Carolina's Twins, and The Trust, do you sense a more sure hand or sure-footed as you've grown? Because it'd be hard. I could pick a page out of Once We Were Brothers and compare it with this and say, well, this is the same writer. But do you feel a sense of growth as a novelist?
I hope so. I hope
but
my
do you
writing
feel it?
Gets better every time. I hope my my sentence structures, the things that you need to do to convey thoughts get better every time. I keep the same main characters from book to book.
Yeah, which is good because
Liam Taggart and
Catherine
Liam
Lockett. Is so into the he was I would say in the previous three books, he's a cool guy. Now he is just, there is so much depth added to this guy that even I can understand why Catherine would be in love with him.
That's one of the things my kid said to me. He said, you know, we really don't know a lot about Liam.
No.
A lot of the books have concentrated on Catherine as the attorney. And
sure.
We don't really know about Liam, so I tried to...
Oh, we know about him now.
Now you know about him.
Well, and you also know not just what he does, but I think you get a real sense in these books of who he is, and I think that's important. So now, Ron Balson, are you at this strange stage that you share with John le Carré of being after a book? Do you know what your next book's going to be, or are you in that weird doldrums?
I'm probably 200 pages into my next book.
Oh, come on.
No,
really?
No, seriously.
Oh, I wanted you to be all angst-filled.
No, Rick, help me. I'm not.
Are you really?
I put probably, what, 6-7 hours into it today, Monica?
Yeah.
Really? Do you write every day or try to write every day?
I can't because I'm busy doing other things, sure. but I try to.
It's amazing. Monica, you are a saint because he's a great guy, but it's not easy to be married to a writer. But you now get to travel to some exotic research places. Ron, I am sorry that Bonnie Kolak, because of this horrible weather, could not drive in. Ron brought, as I will tell Bonnie when she comes on by phone at 10:30, Ron brought an old album to have Bonnie autograph. I guarantee you I will get that autograph for you. I will get that autographed, and I will give her one of your books, too. Because her husband, Bob Wolf, is a writer, too, not a novelist.
I brought one for her.
Huh?
I brought one. I brought the trust for her.
Oh, good.
There you go.
It's a good exchange. Ron Balson, it is ever a pleasure to see you, and it is always a pleasure to read you. Monica, you too. You come in
always great being.
It really is. It's a great story, and you've transcended that. You have a great story, but you tell even better stories. So thank you. We'll take a little break, and we'll talk to Chris Chandler about his updated book about Harold Washington and the Civil Rights Legacy. We will be back momentarily. Welcome back. That's Bonnie Kolak. She'll be on the air at 10:30 to talk about her latest CD. It's always a treat when she comes out with a CD. This one is titled Seems Like Yesterday. And one of the best books ever written about Chicago politics was written in 2014 by the ever-astute Chris Chandler. Chris, how are you?
Just fine.
Good.
Thanks.
It was titled, and we talked about the book when it first came out, Harold Washington and the Civil Rights Legacy. It was about the time that you got involved with that amazing campaign, 1983, for Harold to become Chicago's first black mayor and then worked for him on the fifth floor at City Hall for a couple of years. You've updated the book, Chris. Why?
Well, the main difference now is that I brought the story up to date. That is, I ended it last time in the middle of the 90s, I believe, and I bring it up to date through the Chuy Garcia campaign.
Yeah, which is fascinating to me because I think even during Mr. Garcia's run for mayor against Rahm Emanuel, forcing him into a runoff that I didn't think Ron was ever ready for, that
right.
People forget what an important player Chuy was during the Harold Washington days. Could you remind them, Chris Chandler?
Well, I could say that Harold looked upon Chuy as his most able young politician.
Mm.
He was, and, you know, Chuy gave a eulogy at Washington's funeral, which drew a standing ovation. And in fact, you can get it on YouTube.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it and heard it. And it was, it's not, but to me and to you, you know, Chris Chandler's been a reporter for print and television and as I said before, is an astute reporter and observer of the political scene here as anybody I know. Was the Chewy who ran for mayor anything like the Chewy you knew in those, you know, the golden age of Harold Washington? Was he?
Well, yes, but I have to say that Chewy was elected after I'd left City Hall.
Right.
So I didn't have that relationship with him that I did with that, you know, the 83 people.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Chewy was the same guy. And I think in my bringing it up to date, I point out that the first person he called when he was decided to run was, what's his name now? Conrad Wuerl.
Yeah, yeah.
Remember Conrad?
Sure, sure.
Excuse me. He was
the
task force that supported Washington and played a key role in that 83 primary.
Remind people, Chris.
Well, let me just say that when Chewy called him up this time and tried to enlist him, Conrad said, "No, I'm with Ron."
Yeah. Yeah,
and he'd been offered some things.
Yeah, co-opted by the ever shrewd Mr. Emanuel.
Chewy was the same guy. I think that he didn't have the best PR in this campaign.
Yeah, I agree.
Have you? I mean, that first commercial was pretty lame.
Yep.
But at the end, he came on like gangbusters at the end. I mean, he won the last two debates. He had really good union ads on. You know, he got 44% of the vote.
I know. People forget that, too.
That's the most that anybody's got challenging the Democratic machine since Harold. And he lost the black vote.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Please, please.
Why did he lose the black vote? Well, there's people like Conrad and actually Congressman Rush and even Dorothy Tillman,
mm-hmm.
went with Rahm. But the biggest reason was our president, Barack Obama.
Of course.
And I try to touch on it lightly, but, you know, have you ever read Obama's Dreams of My Father?
Yep.
I just went to it for the first time to read the section on Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Obama was... and it was neutral about council wars.
Yeah, I know.
From 85 to 89 or whatever as a community organizer, and he just didn't care.
Yeah.
He was not on Harold's side.
Yeah,
I
know.
And actually, as a legislator, he took on a regular... Emile Jones,
yeah.
Yeah, who is a regular wheeler dealer.
That's right. You know, Obama...
Was really from the daily tradition.
No, there's no question.
The PR guy, Axelrod, when it was the daily's guy for many elections.
No question. Yeah. Chris's book is Harold Washington and the Civil Rights Legacy. It is fascinating on a number of levels, and just as he's talking about the ways in which it's updated, it does... take a passing glance at the former President Obama and at the current mayor, but it is also incredibly insightful about the coalition that came together, what you call, I think, in the book, Chris, this kind of true believers that gets that phrase gets a bad rap because I think it was.
Well, he reached out to. He saw that a coalition, which would basically be a coalition of black and brown,
mm-hmm.
was enough to win that primary.
Yep.
And he got to know and become partners with Rudy Lozano,
sure.
in the Mexican community,
sure,
Cha-Cha Jimenez in the Puerto Rican community. They became part of the same team.
Yep.
And there was the black nationalism of, you know, Lou Palmer and Conrad Wuerl and Bob Starks. But there was also the Mexican nationalism of Rudy Lozano and the Puerto Rican nationalism you know, that was the real energy in that campaign.
Yeah, that's where your book, and again, the title, you can get it anywhere books are sold, I mean, online or even in stores. Harold Washington.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Harold Washington, The Civil Rights Legacy by Chris Chandler, C-H-A-N-D-L-E-R. You were going to say something?
Oh, I was just going to say the book does start off with Dr. Martin Luther King's 66 Chicago campaign.
Mm.
And then tries to trace the civil rights movement to Harold's campaign. And there's a direct link there.
Oh, no question. Chris Chandler, I I've been an admirer of yours for decades now. And this...
That's just because I was friends with your dad.
Well, everybody was friends with my dad. That's never been a problem.
I didn't know that you were named after Rick Ricardo.
Yes, because my parents used to babysit the Ricardo's children, whose names were Rick Jr., and their daughter's name was Russia. Yeah, isn't that something? Chris, you take care of yourself, and next year, early in the year after the hockey season's over, I want you to come back on and talk more about this, because Harold Washington was an amazing guy.
And he had a big impact on this city.
Oh, no question. Well, and you cover that, and you cover that well, especially in the updated Harold Washington, The Civil Rights Legacy. You take care of yourself, Chris. It's the new edition. The new edition of Harold Washington and the Civil Rights Legacy by Chris Chandler. It's always good to talk to you, Chris. Take care of yourself.
Thanks a lot.
All right, anytime. Bye-bye. He really is something that really, really is a fine, fine book if you want to know anything about politics in this town. You actually would need 100 books, but this should be... among them. Stay tuned. We have some commercials, then we have some news, then we're going to talk to Nate Herman, the comedy legend, former writer for Saturday Night Live and Second City and all sorts of places, about he and some other actors do something called Films for the Ear. And we will tell you what that is all about. And then at 10:30, Bonnie Kolak. Live on the phone, so please stay tuned.
Black-eyed, sweet thing, sugar loose. Honey, you only call me when I'm clean. Off a one-way juice. Mom, I'm a jazz man.
That is the one and only voice of Bonnie Kolak. She'll be joining me... her home. I think she's in her home in Iowa. We'll talk to her on the phone at 10:30, but we're playing cuts, the first cuts heard anywhere on radio in this land, from her latest CD, which is titled Seems Like Yesterday. A very, very old and I think spooky movie is going to be shown at City Lit Theater on Bryn Mawr. It is The Old Dark House, and it's a presentation of, and these guys, some of these guys have been on the show before, they're Films for the Ear gang of people. Nate Herman, a comedy legend, you and Gary Houston concocted this whole thing about 4 years ago, didn't you?
Yeah, at a party at Gary's house.
How did it happen?
We have a mutual friend who was at the party, and we were thinking that he looked exactly like Peter Sellers in the Dr. Strangelove president role.
Uh-huh.
And then we just thought, well, it would be fun to do Dr. Strangelove as a staged reading. And in a staged reading,
sure,
the actors are actually moving around, but they have the scripts in their hands. And after about a couple minutes, the audience apparently doesn't even mind that the actors have the scripts and just go along with it. And we did Strangelove, and it was great. Oh, Tony Adler gave us a nice
Reader. You did it at Space in Evanston.
Oh, God, it was fun.
And you've since done. God. You know, I'm surprised you guys don't have your own website. I'm surprised you don't. Except it's very, the quality of actors, Nate, that you're getting to do this is pretty high, and it's not like they're free all the time and can be there at the drop of a hat whenever you and Gary say, come on, we're doing another one of these shows. You do it whenever you can. You've done, I remember we talked on the air, you and I and Gary, about His Girl Friday, You did network using the legendary anchorman Joel Daly.
That's right.
The Graduate, The Miracle on 34th Street, and The Maltese Falcon. So this one, this new one that's going to take place at City...
Monday night.
Monday night at City Lit Theater, which is at 1020 West Bryn Mawr. It's like $15 at the door, and you get in and see all these talents. We'll talk about all the actors, too. All right, how did this one come about, Nate? Did you say, you call Gary and say, hey, Gary, are you free? Let's get some guys and put on a show.
Gary's been wanting to do this since we got together. And every time he brought it up, we all went, no. and he kept going, let's do the old Dark House. But no. And finally, this year, he said, let's do the old Dark House. We went, okay. And then I watched it. I'd never seen it before.
Neither have I. Talk about this movie. I mean, it starts, first of all, it stars Boris Karloff and Melvin Douglas. And
Raymond Massey.
Right. And Charles
and
Lawton.
It's wonderful. And it was directed, of course, by James Whale, the guy who did Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And The Bride of Frankenstein. And it's beautiful. And it's just been, coincidentally, a new print of it has been reissued, and it's being shown in New York to rave reviews.
Whew. When you saw it, you loved it, right?
Oh, it's wonderful because, you know, James Whale is this wonderfully almost surreal director. It's almost like it's German expressionist cinema, and it's just so beautifully done. But he's also got this really wacky sense of humor, and he pulled out all the stops in this one. The fellow who's the old man at the house is constantly saying to people when they sit down to dinner, "Have a potato," and it becomes a running gag throughout the movie. And Boris Karloff plays the mad butler. Oh, it can't be better.
Now, how does this work? Do you screen the film behind and you take the voices? How does it work? Nobody sees the movie.
No, we're doing a lot. We're doing it as if we were staging the movie, doing a play version of the movie, but we all have our scripts in our hand.
Gotcha.
And we have a minimal set, and it's, you know, Second City style, minimal props.
Sure.
Like I said, after a couple of minutes, the audience just plays along with it and has a wonderful time.
Well, I think they also... Time. Well, and the other thing, Nate, as you well know, I mean, this it doesn't force, but it compels the audience to start using their imaginations. You know what
like
I mean?
Radio did. Yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
I think that's one of the great joys of it. So you decide, Gary calls and says, hey, let's do this again. Let's try to do this again. And
again,
then how
no
do you, then you, do you both start calling actors? Peter
exactly.
Guarino, who is an expert at staged reading from the Shakespeare.
Can you believe he's joining us on this? Isn't
I cannot. I can't believe he's
group.
He does, and they do amazing stuff. These Chicago Shakespeare stuff. He's taking the car. When you do it, where do you get the script?
Most of these scripts are available online,
okay,
which is wonderful, and then we download them. And this year, Peter had the unenviable task of having to take a script, which is essentially just a line-by-line copy of the dialogue from the movie, and he put it into a script format for us, God bless him.
Yeah, he can do that, though. He can do that.
Yeah, you can do that now. Apparently on these things called computers, they're wonderful. Wonderful.
So I hear.
Oh, I have to tell you a story.
Sure.
Yesterday, I'm doing for Ursula Bielski for this month. She asked me to help her out on her ghost
tours. Yeah.
Yes. So yesterday I'm at the Congress Hotel, and I had to put the Wi-Fi onto my phone. Well, it wasn't my phone. I have a flip phone, so I borrowed my wife's smartphone, mm-hmm. and I'm standing there, and the fellow at the desk says, here, put it onto your... How do you turn on the Wi-Fi in here? I go, thank God there was a 14-year-old boy standing next to me. And I turned to him. I said, how do
please,
you put the Wi-Fi in? He said, here you go.
Yeah. That's so funny. Believe me, I understand perfectly. How do you go about, Nate, how do you go about casting this thing? Do you just, literally start making phone calls?
Yeah, Gary and I make the phone calls. Folks love to do it because, you know, they've
because it's fun. Heard about it,
they've talked to other people, and it's such fun doing it. And it's all everybody who does it are just friends of either Gary's or mine.
Yeah.
We don't audition.
Right.
We just ask people to help us out. And they're delighted to do it because they know it's going to be, you know, all of one day's work.
Sure. Sure.
And it's fun, and it's a kick for everybody to do.
Who is Gary playing? Who's Gary Houston playing?
Gary is playing the Charles Laughton role.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he says,
nice.
It's because I have put on some heft, Gary.
You can. And Will Klinger's going to be in this. Peter Guarino, Mark Ulrich, Gray Smith, Sam Beaver, Kim Richard Mowry.
A wonderful guy. He was a student of mine when I was teaching at IO Theater, teaching writing.
Yeah.
And he's delightful. It's, you know, it's hard to find that young leading man type.
Sure,
and,
sure.
Yeah, and Sam is it. He's wonderful.
Have you two, I mean, I know that it does sound, again, this is tomorrow night at, it's a week from Monday. It's a week from Monday.
Week
it's
Monday.
October 30th at the City Light Theater,
before,
which is, yes,
the night Halloween.
Before Halloween.
Of course.
1020 West Bryn Mawr. It's a beautiful second floor space. I think it's $15 at the door, but you can go to, you can send an email. At least you guys have this. Films, at least you have email. Films for the ear at AOL.com.
One word, films for the ear.
Films for the ear, all one word, at AOL.com. You, and I know Gary too, Nate, really have fun with this. I guess it would be impossible to do it with any sort of regularity as busy as you all are. You're all working actors. You're not pulling people in off the street, for God's sake. You know what I mean?
Which is why we do it about, you know, all of four times a year.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
I would love if we did it regularly, but like you say, you know, people work for a living.
That's true. People have to work for a living. Well,
yeah,
I got it.
Yeah.
Now, I want to see, where can people see this movie if after the film
well,
for the year?
Well, it's probably going to be coming into wide release. It's in New York now. But in the meanwhile, you can pull it up on YouTube.
Wow. Has everybody who's going to be in the show seen the film?
Yeah. We've all watched it on YouTube.
And you all love the film? This is one.
Yeah.
Or
you
like
can't
it.
Help. You can't help, but it's done so wonderful, so almost tongue-in-cheek. And Melvin Douglas is great. He just is almost laughing his way through the performance. he's having such a good time. And Charles Laughton is, too, in this wonderfully corny Welsh or Lowlands accent that I hope Gary recreates. And it's just some, and the part of the homeowner, Horace, was in the movie, this fellow Ernest Thesinger, who you remember if you saw Bride of Frankenstein.
Sure.
He was Dr. Pretorius.
Oh, my God.
The tall, lanky guy.
Wow.
Yeah.
This really
and
seems.
Kim Richard Mowry is playing him. And, oh, it's going to be fun.
This really seems like a wonderful, wonderful, very creatively adult way to spend the day before Halloween. It is taking place a week from Monday, October 30th, at the City Lit Theater in Edgewater, 1020 West Bryn Mawr. Really easy to find. You can go to...
Right off of Sheridan Road.
Just off Sheridan Road. You can also take the L off there and walk a little east. Films for the ear at AOL.com is the way to find it. Nate, are you coming to Lewis University tomorrow?
I will see you tomorrow night.
Good. Fantastic.
Good.
Nate is also a teacher of the highest order, as well as being with Gary Houston. I'm going to call you guys impresarios for starting this thing.
Yes,
it started.
Right.
Yes, Rick, it started at a party. I didn't doubt that. I didn't doubt that for a second. Nate, thanks for staying up, and I'll see you tomorrow.
I'll see you tomorrow night.
All right,
thanks
pal.
So much,
thanks
Rick.
A million. It is. Doesn't that sound like fun, ladies and gentlemen? It really should be. These are really, really talented actors too, and if they have fun, you will have fun. I'm going to take a commercial break, then I'm going to tell you a couple little things I want to tell you, and then we will have Bonnie Kolak. Donnie will be on shortly, so please stay tuned. I got a kind of sad email from a friend of mine about her dad, who was once one of the best guests I've ever had. He was kind of a, he was a cop, and he was a sort of amateur but passionate, passionate historian. His name was Jerry O'Sullivan, and they had a wake, and there were more than 700 people there. I sadly was not among them. He had a long career as a police officer and was a real mentor to other younger police officers. One of his friends, a guy named Dennis Bingham, was a former speechwriter for Police Superintendent Terry Hilliard, had a few things to say about him. He wrote a letter to Meg, to Margaret, my friend, who introduced me to her dad, Jerry, and he really was a passionate sort of lover of Chicago and history. And so this is, he was an amateur historian, but he was as good as many so-called professionals I know. This is some of what Dennis Bingham wrote about Jerry O'Sullivan. He knew him much better than I did. I was just a fan. He wrote, as you were well aware, it's impossible to convey in words how truly a special person your dad was. His long career as a Chicago police officer and police captain, he displayed as many qualities, foremost of which was his compassion for others. A gentle, kind, thoughtful, and compassionate man in a tough profession. No kidding. His passion for the history and traditions of the Chicago Police Department was unmatched. Unmatched. He had a vast knowledge of the department's past, coupled with his decades-long career on the job. He was a very, very decent, good man, and I am sorry that he died way too young. He also ran in the first Chicago Marathon, which took place in 1977. Meg and the rest of your family, I'm sorry. He was a great guy and also a great radio guest. Welcome back. It is my unbelievable pleasure to have on the phone the one and only Bonnie Kolak. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I'm great. Yeah, it's always good to be back in Chicago. I feel like I'm home.
Well, you're going to do it. This is your home. That's what I think. And you always look, the great thing about you, because of our mutual friend, the great Charles Osgood, who's taken probably 18 million pictures of you in your life, you never age. I don't know whether it's his genius or it's his genes or something. You never age. On this new CD... don't you agree? I know.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I know.
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
And he's taken pictures. Listen. He's taken pictures of me, and I get older in every one of them. It's crazy. It's insane.
Well, the thing is to use old pictures.
Well, the great thing, you would have loved, buddy. I had on at 9 o'clock a guest, a really fascinating novelist who became a kind of best-selling novelist when he was pushing 70, and he had known you were coming in, and he, when I said, oh no, Bonnie couldn't drive, it's rainy, it's crazy, I told her to stay out, he goes, oh no, he's here with his wife, his beautiful wife, and he pulls out the close-up album. Your close-up album.
Oh, my God.
I know. I wanted her to autograph this. I said, look. And so I invited him to come to the space, and he goes, I saw her at the Earl of Old Town. I think it's somebody else's troubles and blah, blah, blah. Bonnie, how did this new CD come to be, seems like yesterday? I cannot stop listening to it.
Oh, great. Well, someone told me that they had there were tapes that had been recorded at Amazing Grace years ago.
Wow.
And did you ever go to Amazing Grace?
Oh, yeah, sure. Oh, my God. I'm going to have you in a second describe that place, because you'll do it better justice than I do, because you performed there. It was a great place to listen. It was a great philosophy. It was a great aesthetic. It was all of that. So you heard that, my God, someone recorded me in the 70s, right?
Right. And what it was, well, Amazing Grace at first was on the campus at Northwestern.
Right.
I don't know if you ever went there. But then, and that was really magical. You could see everybody sitting on the grass outside and stuff. It was, I don't know, it wasn't a garage. It was like a little house, but it mm-hmm. was just. And then they moved later, I think it was on Chicago Avenue in Evanston.
Right, right.
And they always had really good sound, which for me is like really, really important. And it was not only good sound out in the room, it was very good sound on the stage.
Yeah.
People, a lot of people don't realize that what they hear out in the room is not what I hear on the stage. So sometimes when the sound is not very good, it's, I mean, you can perform, you can sing, but it's a joy, and you really relax when it sounds good to you, what you are hearing.
Sure, sure.
And so, we found these tapes that were recorded, and it was in a transitional period for me. I was sort of switching musicians. Mm-hmm. And that's when, so I'm not sure of everyone playing on these songs because I can't remember exactly who was playing what. I know that Elliot Delman, Elliot was with me early on, and actually he's written one of the songs, Mama Do This, which is on this CD.
Mm-hmm.
And Elliot's going to be working with me when I'm at Space. And so, actually, we're rehearsing tomorrow.
Oh.
And it's so great because Elliot is just great, and he always made me laugh. He's extremely funny.
Well, that's probably true of Ed Holstein, too, with whom you're performing.
Eddie
is every time I've ever seen Eddie, he makes me laugh about something. He's just got...
Oh, he always does. He's extremely funny.
Was there any, on your part, Bonnie Kolak, was there any trepidation about hearing recordings from that long ago, or were you just overjoyed that they existed?
No, it doesn't bother me to hear them as long as it's stuff that I think worked.
Yeah.
You know, I've always been incredibly critical, and so I would never really listen to my stuff. And if I feel like it was a good performance, then I'm fine with it. And I think that especially people who listened to my music a long time ago are really going to enjoy this CD.
No question.
There's really quite lovely things on it.
No question. And you sound, I mean, is your, you know, you know me, and, you know, I've been in love with you and your voice for as long as I've known you. Has your voice, does this sound like a young Bonnie Kolak to you, or does it sound like you?
It sounds like me, but my voice has gotten darker.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually richer now than it was. It was really pristine, and I still sound pretty much like that.
Yeah.
Age at one point will probably take that away. It hasn't done it yet.
Don't let that happen. No. Get Osgood involved.
It's like being an athlete.
Get Osgood involved somehow to keep you anxious. I want to do two things, Bonnie. I want people to hear, because I love this CD. It seems like yesterday. If you can indulge them for about 3 minutes to hear "Roll Away the Gray," which I think is just a beautiful, beautiful song. Who wrote that song? That was Bob Carpenter,
a young
right?
guy at that time, Bob Carpenter. He was from Canada, and it turned out, he wrote Burgundy Wine also.
Hmm.
He was a really very poetic writer and very sad. Bob died when I think he was about 50 years old.
Oh, that is sad.
He was a really fine writer.
Well, Bonnie Kolak, you really do this song justice. Aubrey, if we could play a couple minutes, Bonnie, sit tight, and I'll get back to you, and then we'll talk some more, and We'll talk about the work of your you got the world's greatest photographer in Chuck Osgood. You got the world's greatest husband in Bob Wolf. Nothing is missing in your life, Bonnie Kolak. Nothing.
I'm pretty lucky, you and are, I've got great dogs, too.
Yeah, you do have great dogs. The album and a CD, in a way, is like dedicated to all the great dogs you've had. Here, ladies and gentlemen.
I know.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, someone said to me, is there a dog song on this? And I said, no, but I can put them on there if I want to.
She'll do the dog songs live at the Acorn Theater.
Yes, that's right.
At the Acorn Theater, right. Next Sunday, on November 19th at the Space. Here, ladies and gentlemen, is Bonnie Kolak from her latest CD, Seems Like Yesterday.
Roll away the gray clouds, let the sunlight shine. Roll away today, clouds, tomorrow will be fine. Come on, roll away the gray clouds, let the sunlight shine. Roll away today, clouds, tomorrow will be fine. Roll away the gray clouds, and let the sunlight shine. Roll away today, clouds, tomorrow will be fine. On the shores of fantasy, between the walls of chance, I saw the perfect tragedy perform its perfect dance. But I grow colder in the night when no one comes inside. Part of me can hardly see, the other part is blind. So you roll away the gray clouds and let the sunlight shine. Roll away today, clouds, tomorrow will be fine. Someone from the space beyond, the place beyond my fear, he came to tell me yesterday that no one else is here. Oh, but come away, and leave this place behind. Come away, oh, come away, and leave this place behind. Roll away the gray clouds, let the sunlight shine. Roll away today, clouds, tomorrow will be fine.
God, Bonnie, that is unbelievable. One of the great things about it is, I think this is such an aptly titled CD, Seems Like Yesterday, to hear you. Well, it's always true when I hear you sing, I am transported back to some other time and place. I'm either sitting in Shuba's or I'm sitting in the Earl. Is that, when you decided to call this Seems Like Yesterday, what was behind that title?
Well, it just came to me. I mean, it was just seemed like that's what it should be. What's really funny is that people place me in certain periods of time in their life.
Yeah.
And so I never think of it as, it's not really real. It's really funny. I don't really think about what I've done very much. And time really doesn't have anything to do with my songs or my singing. It's just really funny. I don't know. There's not time. I don't place myself in the past.
A song doesn't
and
take
I'm
you.
Really, well, and at that time, I have been so much happier in my older life. I mean, a lot of hard times when I listen back.
Sure.
And it's, I don't know, it's what saved me. Singing is my greatest joy in my whole life, and it's physically so incredibly amazing to be able to make all these sounds and place them in the right way. And when I sang this song, all of my, I always feel like if you can get through all the hard times in life, and life is hard for everybody,
mm-hmm.
I don't know who they are. And I just feel that for me, singing has been so healing. And in my music, I wanted people to feel like you can go through stuff, and if you can get through it, that there'll be a better day. You'll be okay, and it just makes you more whole. And when I was singing that, I can hear it in my voice because I was really singing it really strong.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you what it is to be the instrument. It's amazing. Mm. And nothing in singing was ever, ever, ever hard for me. I mean, I changed. You gradually change as an artist. You learn new things, and you learn to phrase better. But the physical thing of singing was, I was really experimenting right from the get-go, and I've always loved melody because my voice would allow me to do that. And I really, it's funny, I don't think of it as in the past.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So
well, you think of it, well,
still
the other,
my great joy.
Well, and the other thing is, I mean, you've got an engagement, and I know, I having seen you perform any number of times, I mean, there's a shared joy. You transmit, I think, that joy you just articulated so beautifully to the people listening. And it's okay if they're, you know, thinking back to, ooh, the Earl of Old Town or whatever it is, but you're transmitting the joy of the moment. Is Eddie performing with you at the Acorn as well as at Space?
Yes, he's opening for me, and I really have him open for me when I have the chance to do that, because he's just so delightful and makes everybody laugh. And let me tell you, the older that you get, the more I laugh more than now than I ever have in my whole life.
Same here.
Yeah, you'd have to. And it's, I don't know, maybe it's the joy of having come through all this crap in our life that it frees you to have much better sense of humor.
Well, one of the things, too, you're performing at two of the, as amazing a place as Amazing Grace was, and it truly was, you're performing at two of the equally amazing places.
I love both these places.
Next Sunday at the Acorn Theater in Three
and
Oaks.
And the Acorn is, too.
Yeah, they are both just great places. Do you have to stay at Osgood's house when you're up there? Does he make you stay there?
I will stay at Bob Swan and his wife Barbara's house.
Yeah, there are a lot of nice people up there.
My poor friend.
Stop. And now, what is your husband? What's Bob? What is Bob Wolf working on? What's Bob?
Oh, he's always working on a book. Don't ask me what it is, but yes, he's working on another book.
Good.
And he's had lots of projects. He's always involved. Bob is so, he works every day. He's very disciplined.
No kidding.
Unlike me.
Yes, unlike me too. Yeah.
Yeah, he is.
And like he and Osgood, the most disciplined man on the planet.
Oh yes. Oh yes.
Bonnie, I can't wait to see you. I can't come up and see you at the Acorn, but I will see you at Space, and I can't wait, and I cannot wait. This Ron Balson, this lovely fan of yours, autographed his novel for you, and then he wants me to bring up your ancient album, as we used to call them, and you can autograph that for him. Bonnie, it's always great to talk to you, sweetie, and congratulations on this. This is really on every level. I'm going to, for you people who still buy a newspaper, I'm going to write about the CD for this Tuesday's paper and give you more information.
Thank
about
you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Bonnie.
It blew me away.
And I
love being back in my beloved Chicago.
Oh, I know. And Chicago loves you. I mean, when you have a guest come in, I thought Ron Balson was going to strangle me when I said, well, Bonnie couldn't, it's raining. She's not going to drive in. I'll tell you the whole story when I see you. Bonnie Kolak, and all you people, read the paper Tuesday. Here she is again off this incredible new, it's her 15th, I think, CD or album, as I like to say. Seems Like Yesterday. Here she is singing an amazing version of Joni Mitchell's River.
It seems like there's always been a river running through my life somewhere, because I spent a lot of time fishing and tramping around on the Wapsipinicon River in Iowa, and now I sort of, I'm in league with another river, and I used to go skating back into the woods, and you could skate way back in the wintertime and lay down in the snow and make angels in the snow, and the silence was so wonderful, it would roar in your head, and you could almost feel like your spirit would leave your body. And that's what I think about on this song. It's called River. Christmas, and they're cutting down the trees. They're putting up reindeer, singing songs of joy and peace. And I wish I had a river that I could skate away on. But it don't snow here, it stays pretty green. I'm gonna make me a lot of money, then I'm gonna quit this crazy scene. And I wish I had a river that I could skate away on.